I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. On today's show, we are discussing coverage of the latest events in Iran, the U.S. assassination of Qassem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Quds Force, and the pundits who've appeared on national TV and in major publications praising the assassinations have undisclosed ties to the weapons industry. We then saw angry protests in many, many cities across Iran, mainly by university students, after the Iranian government admitted it accidentally shot down a passenger plane, killing all 176 passengers and crew members on board. Today, we're joined by Borzu Daragahi, an international correspondent for The Independent. In one of his latest pieces, Borzu reports that the destruction of the flight and the deaths of the mostly Iranian passengers have infuriated citizens across the political spectrum. Many are angry about the days of denial by senior military and government officials following the crash. Many of those killed were young graduates of Iran's most elite and prestigious educational institutions, heading back to promising jobs or research slots in Canada following winter holidays with relatives. Hi, Borzu. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're also joined by Lee Fong, a reporter covering the influence of organized interest groups and money for The Intercept. And Lee has a piece about pundits praising Soleimani, neglecting to disclose ties to the arms industry. Hi, Lee. Thank you for joining us. Nice to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to start off with both of you by focusing on news that really stood out for you this week. It could be about Iran or anything else. Lee, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, you know, this isn't particularly new, but I want to use this as my example because I just read it in the December edition of the late December edition of The New Yorker, the Dexter Filikens piece about Prime Minister Modi and his kind of ethno-nationalist, Hindu nationalist drive to reshape India, looking at his efforts to stoke hatred towards the minority Muslim population and to control and really censor and intimidate the press. Almost half the piece talks about efforts by various journalists just to get out the truth and how difficult that's been, whether that's calls for ethnic violence or the crackdown in Kashmir, all the kind of political strategies that he's using to tighten and remake formerly independent institutions in India to represent his brand of Hindu nationalism. It's a fantastic piece, and you know, it's really worth reading.
Thank you so much for bringing this up, Lee, because we have not covered this yet. This is a piece by Dexter Filikens in The New Yorker, Blood and Soil in Narendra Modi's India. And we'll put a link right after the show at yourcallradio.org. What about you, Borzu? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I mean, I've just been so chin deep in Iran stuff and other Middle East stuff, including Libya, that I don't even remember where I read it. But it was a really smart piece. I think maybe it was on CNN's website about Australia and how the fires afflicting Australia are mostly in the south, where land management is under the control of the descendants of the white colonialists, whereas the north of Australia, which is actually hotter, where, you know, the Aboriginal kind of fire management and forest techniques still prevail, you have not had these fires. And I just thought, in general, I just wanted to point to that catastrophe, because, you know, we're also focused on political stuff and the rise of populism and the tensions in the Middle East and so on, but really White Walkers in the Game of Thrones is the environment and what's happening to our climate. And the most horrifying and, you know, under-reported story right now is Australia.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Borzu. We're going to cover Australia in the next couple of weeks, but because of the time difference, we have to do a pre-tape and then air it. And Borzu, we have a problem with your line, and so we're going to... Oh, I think that's better, actually. Can you just... we're going to talk with you about Iran in a minute, Borzu. I lost you for a minute. Are you back now?
Yeah, I'm back, yeah.
Okay, great. You sound better now. Thank you. So we will try to find that piece. Yeah, in fact, a lot of people are talking about, you know, they always come up with these lines about, oh, indigenous practices during these fires. And so we're going to focus on that in the coming week. So thank you so much for also bringing up the Australia fires. Borzu, let's dive in, and we're going to talk about Iran for the whole hour. Let's talk about all of the protests that we are seeing as a result of the Iranian government shooting down the passenger plane that killed all 176 passengers and crew on board. One of your latest pieces is called "We Want Prosecutions: Iran Rocked by Protests for Third Day After Security Forces Shot at Demonstrators." And you wrote this 3 days ago. Since then, Amnesty International has come out with reports, which we will talk about. But can you just tell us, how are you reporting on what's happening inside Iran?
I mean, everything in Iran that happens, people videotape or post about. You have to go to Telegram, the messaging app that, you know, it's got a very high penetration rate in Iran. And you, you know, look for the videos that people post. You try to get them verified to the extent that you can. You reach out to the people who are posting those videos. You ask them, you know, who they are, and if they chat with you, and they often do. And then, you know, through that mechanism, you kind of put together a piece about what's going on in Iran. I also have been to these locations. You know, so when they talk about Sharif University, I know the bridge that's next to Amir Kabir University, the overpass there. And so I know these locales just a bit. So it's a little bit helpful in that sense that I can picture what's going on and where it's happening.
Let's talk about the anger that we're seeing on the streets. As you report, many of those killed in the crash were young graduates of Iran's most elite and prestigious educational institutions. And over the last week, there have been videos of people remembering loved ones. There have been paintings of faces. People in Canada are really mourning. So tell us a little bit about some of the people who were on that plane.
Well, I mean, look, there is people who have graduates, and I'm not familiar with them. I don't know them. Although I actually found out just the other day that one is a friend of a very good friend. Look, you know, let's put these into perspective. These protests are over for now. The anger is still there. The rage is still there. The discontent with the regime has always been there. But, you know, as far as the street protests, they were, you know, rather small comparatively. They were never a big threat to the regime, except that they were among the elite. And you could see the government, to contrast how the government handled protests in November, which were more working class kids and people in the provinces, members of ethnic minorities in far-flung kind of places, versus how they treated the protests here. There was not one single person killed in the recent protests. Mm-hmm. They did not use lethal force. They used force, but, you know, kind of classic crowd control techniques. So, you know, they were very sensitive about this particular group of people, because if they rebel, it would be perhaps more trouble for the regime.
This is interesting, because we reported on the protests that were sparked by the hike in gas prices. And at that time, I mean, the government has a history of using violence to crack down on demonstrations. But a few months ago, according to Amnesty International, over 300 people were killed in those demonstrations. 7,000 were arrested. The government has not published the exact figure of how many were killed. And we saw heavy, heavy deployment of security forces in videos. And so what you're saying is, the violence wasn't as brutal this time, but according to Amnesty, people were rounded up. It's just that people are not being killed. We're not killed this time, right?
Yeah, I mean, Iran is such a classist society in many ways that, you know, they treat the different protests with different types of violence at this point. You know, if listeners recall, in 2009, there was months and months and months and months and months of protests that really threatened the regime. And during that whole time, you know, only like maybe 100 people were killed in that nearly a year of protests, and all over the country. But those were the elite. So the regime dealt with it one way. And then you had these protests out, you know, among poor people and in the provinces and so on, and the regime just, you know, opened fire viciously in November. So I think that just says something about the nature of the society there and the prejudices.
That is Borzu Dargahi. He's an international correspondent from The Independent. He's joining us from Istanbul, and I'm sorry about the quality of his line. Borzu, we're going to try to call you back to hopefully get a better connection. We're also joined today by Lee Fong. He's a reporter covering the influence of interest groups and money in politics for The Intercept. And Lee, hopefully we can get a better line with Borzu. I wanted just to ask you, overall, the coverage of Iran. I mean, you have done so much reporting on the U.S. invasion of Iraq and what the media have or have not learned from that reporting. I mean, this is a pretty general question, but when you have an incident like the assassination of Soleimani and, you know, the sanctions on Iran and the nuclear deal, what are your thoughts about what the media have or have not learned from the big mistakes many made when it came to reporting on the U.S. invasion of Iraq?
Well, I think we have to divide this, or my answer up to this question, because in broadcast media, on the big television networks, on cable news, and to some extent, you know, mainstream corporate media, radio, we see very few lessons learned. We, you know, on the major networks, we're seeing literally the same cast of pundits who appeared in 2001 and 2002 and 2003 in the build-up to the Iraq War, beating the drums of war, basically taking any claim by the government and repeating it uncritically, and in some cases actually hyping it and saying even more extreme claims than what the Trump administration is making, saying that we need to punish the Iranians, we need to bomb their oil refineries, we need to consider a much more robust military, even potential invasion. On the flip side of that, I think there has been a little bit of a change in terms of print media and online media, and I don't know exactly how to qualify this, but also social media, where a lot of these claims are being from the government calling for a military escalation are being looked at with a lot more skepticism, with a lot more criticism. There's a much broader pushback. There's also a number of figures in the Democratic Party who existed, you know, and were around 10 or 20 years ago, but were essentially silenced or never received a prominent voice in the media, who now have a platform to speak out against the war or at least feel emboldened to speak out in a more prominent way. You've seen a number of members of Congress in California. Ro Khanna has been completely outspoken, pushing back, and he's received a great deal of coverage for his pushbacks. Several senators, Chris Murphy of Connecticut, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who have been on the media almost every day talking about the drumbeat of war and pushing back against the administration's claims. And we're seeing, again, print media being much more skeptical this time. So, you know, there's a little bit of a division. Broadcast media, for whatever reason, has not, in general, really changed its behavior. But in some ways, we are seeing reporters ask more questions.
And we'll talk about the piece you wrote for The Intercept about this a little later in the show. That's Lee Fong, reporter with The Intercept, and Borzu Dargahi is an international correspondent for The Independent. And I think we have a better line for you, Borzu. I just wanted to ask you another question about the protests. Can you tell us about some of these amnesty reports that come out? One just came out, and you tweeted about it a couple of days ago, that scores were injured as security forces used unlawful force to crush protesters. One woman, Masha, was quoted as saying, "There was so much tear gas, I was so mentally stressed and anxious that I initially didn't even realize that I had been shot."
I mean, what could I say to that? You know, are the security forces using weapons? They say they're not using lethal weapons, the official security forces. However, that means nothing with regard to the unofficial paramilitary militias that are, you know, really unaccountable and an unaccountable force. And they were also spotted in the streets and in videos uploaded to the internet. So, you know, I mean, is it possible that, part of the official security forces are using non-lethal force? And perhaps even without their knowledge or coordination, you have these, you know, freelance militias that are loyal to one cleric in Rome or to a certain foundation or, you know, just sort of on the supreme leader's secret bankroll or something, also terrorizing people but using live weapons.
And Borzu, overall, what are you hearing from the young people, especially university students who've been taking to the streets the last few days? What else are they calling for?
Look, they're angry. People are angry. They want some accountability in this issue. They want resignations. No one has announced their... Think about this. You know, this is a massive calamity. The armed forces shot down a civilian plane, and, you know, the guy... goes on TV and he says, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I can't believe this happened. I wish it was me. I wish I was dead." You know, but yet he's still in his job. He wishes he was dead, announcing it on live TV. Yet he hasn't resigned. So it's a little bit outrageous to people. On the other hand, these are people with a stake in the current status quo. These are people with, you know, decent jobs and decent futures. This is a regime that has proven over and over again that it's willing to do anything to stay in power. And for most people, it's too much of a cost to pay. They'd rather go on with their lives, try to maybe make their way west or accommodate with the regime rather than risk their lives against in terms of trying to topple a system that is so determined to stay in power.
Another headline that is leading the news today, in fact, I think it just led the BBC, is that Iran's supreme leader, and right now I'm reading from CBS, took the unusual step of delivering a Friday sermon this week. He's 80 years old. He took it upon himself to convey a vigorous defense of his military forces after they shot down that plane and railed against the Trump administration as clowns trying to deceive the Iranian people. Some people say that in recent days, his presence after 8 years means that he has a significant measure, a message to deliver. Others say that because it's been so long, he's no longer fit for this job. How is this being covered, and what are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, yes, he hasn't delivered a Friday prayer sermon in years, but he gives speeches a lot. He talks a lot, maybe not as much as Trump or Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, but he gives a lot of speeches. And so his words are often very predictable and so on. And today, I'm not sure why he decided to deliver the Friday prayer sermon that's usually delivered by another high-ranking cleric. But the tone that I got from his speech was doubling down on defiance, no compromise, not with Iran's domestic dissidents and opponents, no compromise with the U.S., and no compromise even with the European powers who've been trying to play a mediating role, just a real message of defiance, but completely and utterly predictable.
That is Borzu Daragahi, international correspondent for The Independent. He's joining us from Istanbul. Li Fong is a reporter with The Intercept. And if you have any questions or comments about all of the media coverage around Iran, whether it's the protests, the plane that was shot down, the assassination of Soleimani, also, what do you think of the coverage in the U.S. media of these events? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Borzu, one more question about this sermon, since it's going to get, you know, headline news today. Is this for the regime's base? Is it a message to the West and the rest of the population? What do you think?
I think there was an element of trying to keep the troops rallied and trying to keep them, whipped up and keeping them supportive of the regime and sending the message out that, now is not the time to compromise. But also it may simply have been, and to sort of use another bit of Trumpian wisdom that we've learned in recent years, it might have been him. One analyst was saying that this was an attempt by him to, lift his own sagging spirits by, going in front of a big audience of people who are big supporters, hearing their cheers and chants and so on, and make himself feel a little bit better. Does that sound familiar?
Yes, very familiar. We're going to get calls in a minute, but I wanted to also bring it back to the assassination of Soleimani. And I know, Borzu, do you have about 10 more minutes to stick around?
Sure.
Okay, great. I wanted to ask you, Lee, and then Borzu, I think one thing that struck me about the assassination of Soleimani is the media were very quick to figure out who he was because a lot of people had never heard of him, at least in the United States. And so they tried to figure out who he was and what he has done. And then they made very blanket statements about what Iranians thought of Soleimani. And the question that I wanted to know and still want to know is who came up with this idea to attack Soleimani and his car? Who is actually calling the shots in the Trump administration? Lee, have you seen that answered in the U.S. media?
No, I haven't. And those are the types of questions that should be asked and attempted to answer by journalists. Since the appointment of John Bolton as National Security Advisor, he left last fall and has been replaced with Robert O'Brien. But during his tenure at the NSC, we saw that Bolton recruited a large number of very hawkish people with the neoconservative ideology to staff the NSC, particularly on the Iran desk, to shape Iran policy. There's a story in Bloomberg News just the other day that one of the individuals hired by Bolton to shape and advise on Iran policy was an individual named Richard Goldberg. He actually, using a kind of a special government waiver, even though he was working at the White House, his salary was not paid by taxpayers. His salary was paid by an outside pressure group, the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. This is a very influential, although not very well-known, think tank in Washington, D.C. that is singularly obsessed with increasing military escalation with Iran. They were the leading force in attempting to defeat the Iran nuclear deal. They're still lobbying on an almost daily basis to pressure European governments and to continue pressure on the Trump administration to completely get rid of that deal. And they've called for more military aggression with Iran. So this is an outside pressure group that had one of their top officials at the NSC shaping Iran policy with his salary still paid by the FDD while working at the White House. And there are several other former alumni of the American Enterprise Institute, another hawkish institution with former employees at NSC and other former FDD employees at the NSC. So just in the last year and a half, Trump is, of course, known for, cycling in lots of different staffers and cabinet members. There's a lot of change constantly in the White House. But in the last 12 months, we've seen a number of these very hawkish individuals advising him on national security policy.
What is the name of the first group you mentioned, Lee?
The Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Okay, I haven't heard about that one. I'll ask you more about that after a break and after we let Borzu go. Borzu, what would you add around the question about who is actually calling the shots when it comes to U.S. foreign policy?
I mean, I think it's obviously it's just Trump, and he's yes, advised by people, but in this particular case, it's pretty obvious to me that this was about the sacking of the U.S. embassy in Baghdad by Iraqi militias who are backed by Iran. And he was presented with a bunch of options, and he said, let's go after Soleimani. According to the accounts that I read, some of the commanders and military officials in the room were shocked by that, but they had the plan in place, and they, you know, pulled it out of the cabinet, the PowerPoint presentation, and went through with it. And it was basically focused on his domestic political concerns, not wanting to seem like Hillary Clinton and Benghazi, or even worse, Jimmy Carter and the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
Well, Borzi, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
Borzu Dargahi is an international correspondent for The Independent, and you can find a few of his last pieces at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with The Intercept's Li Fong, and we will talk more about the piece he wrote about TV pundits praising Soleimani's assassination, neglecting to disclose ties to the weapons industry. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are discussing the latest events in Iran. We're talking with Li Fong, a reporter covering the influence of money in politics for The Intercept. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any comments, questions about the coverage that you have seen, also, just what do you, when you think about what the media have learned after the invasion of Iraq, what do you think about how the media cover something like this, the assassination, the tension between the United States and Iran? Of course, so many activists were on the streets saying no war with Iran. If you have any questions about that, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or tweet at Your Call Radio. We have an email from Bill who says, thank you for your intrepid approach to reporting important issues. I am heartened to hear the statement that Soleimani was assassinated at the direction of the president. I believe that a Fox reporter described the event in the terms that the general passed away. Most news outlets describe the results of this premeditated attack on a military officer on a third nation soil simply as death. I'm in my 70s and feel that I've witnessed continuing mortal blows of the integrity of journalism, the inability to openly and clearly report events without pandering to the pressure to conform has been the demise of the reporting that I want. Well, thank you for the email, Bill. What are your thoughts about this, Lee? First, let's talk about the word assassination. Some news organizations like the Associated Press acknowledged that they were mostly refraining from describing the killing as an assassination because it, quote, would require that the news service decide that the act was a murder and because the term is politically freighted, end quote. Your colleague, James Risen, who used to work at The New York Times and now is at The Intercept, said avoiding that word is cowardly and likened it to news organizations using descriptions like enhanced or harsh interrogation instead of torture when covering what happened during the Bush administration. He says it's a silly debate. It's an assassination. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think the easiest way to evaluate this is to just look at it at the flip side and imagine if the United States was placed in a position where a foreign power decided to fly over with a drone and fire a missile at one of our top generals in a coordinated attempt to kill him or her. We would absolutely describe that incident as an assassination. So there's no reason we should sanitize our language when our country does this to others. And, you know, I think this gets back again to like the dueling media narratives. You know, the Trump administration has attempted to portray this as a defensive act that Soleimani was an imminent threat. And the only way to save lives, to save American lives, was to take him out as fast as possible. But, you know, and we've seen many people, many pundits repeat this narrative over and over again, especially in television media. But as the Washington Post reported, this was more of a tit for tat. You know, 2 weeks ago, apparently Iranian-backed militias, or at least alleged Iranian-backed militias, had fired missiles at a U.S. base in Iraq. One of those missiles killed an American contractor, a translator. In retaliation, the U.S. then fired rockets and missiles at those militia groups. In retaliation to that, Iranian-backed protesters stormed the embassy. And then in retaliation for that, Qasem Soleimani was assassinated. That's, you know, from the most detailed reporting from The Washington Post, The New York Times and others, that's the sequence of events that happened. And as Borzo mentioned, Trump clearly did have domestic political concerns rather than national security concerns in mind. He didn't want another Benghazi. He didn't want a political catastrophe coming into his reelection year. There's really been no intelligence that's been presented to either lawmakers or to the public showing that Soleimani posed an imminent threat. But despite all of that, if you're watching Fox News, if you're watching a lot of the major networks, that's not what you're hearing. You're hearing that Soleimani was one of the most powerful terrorists in the world, that he was very close to killing many more Americans. You know, all of these claims that are hyperbolic, that aren't tied to actual reporting, that's the narrative that you tend to hear when you tune in to television news.
And yet Trump administration officials, you know, say that he was planning an imminent attack, but they haven't been able to come up with justification. So you have U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo acknowledging last week that the U.S. did not know precisely when or where the attacks would take place. Last Sunday, U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper contradicted Trump, saying he didn't know of any evidence of specific attacks being planned against foreign embassies. Quote, the president didn't say there was a tangible. He didn't cite a specific piece of evidence, end quote. So then this eventually came out.
Well, that should be the scandal right there, that the defense secretary, you know, President Trump's appointee to lead the military, couldn't present any evidence of an imminent attack. I mean, that kind of eviscerates the entire narrative, and that should be the story, and that should be the kind of leading factor in covering this. But, you know, with Trump being, you know, so capable of shaping the news coverage with his tweets and his messages, he's certainly muddled, I think, Americans' understanding of the event.
Mm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. And can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're fine. Go ahead.
I'm on a sofa. Thank you. Thank you, and thank your panel. And I'll try to make this short. I think, to me, what's gone on recently is what more in the long line of American assassinations of people we don't care for. I'd like to hear from the panel. In this day and age, what do you think you can do to help listeners like me fight the sense of ennui or apathy that comes out of thinking you're part of a global network of power? I think we can do things within our own country. But I'd like to hear from you. What do you think actually people inside the country can do to shape, you know, some of this force? It seems at times just like you're watching a horrific film that you have no ability to affect. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Robert. This is a question we get every show, Lee, and something we try to answer. What are your thoughts on this, especially when it comes to affecting U.S. foreign policy?
Well, this is difficult because, you know, we've seen so many protests, chants in the street, you know, people marching, and to some degree, they seem to influence certain politicians, but on balance, it doesn't seem to change a lot in terms of policy. And I would just say that look at recent history on areas outside of foreign policy to maybe learn tactics or, you know, experiences that could be applied to foreign policy. Just remember, just a few years ago, Republicans held both the House and the Senate, and Trump came, you know, within a hair of repealing the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare. But what really kind of changed the calculus was that so many Americans went to town halls with their legislators, went and met with their legislators, went and protested their legislators, held really sophisticated forms of advocacy to push back and say and to explain how angry they would be, how they would be personally affected by a repeal of health care. And at the end of the day, even though Republicans had the numbers, they certainly had the political power to repeal Obamacare, because of that outpouring of public opinion and advocacy, they backed down. You know, for foreign policy, you know, it, just like any other government policy, it requires a groundswell of public opinion and advocacy, and the really sophisticated advocacy that does everything it can to shape lawmakers' opinions and to provide political incentives for their actions. So, I can't say exactly how to change this. I don't think anyone really knows. But look at other areas where large numbers of the public have actually shaped and changed the course of history.
Mm. Well, thank you for that question, Robert. We will continue asking that question and asking our guests to answer that. It's a really important one. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Greg in Mountain View. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just want to ask, you know, if you, if your guests think that there's actually a pathway to actually having a successful foreign policy. You know, right now I just feel like we're just, it's about spending money on defense instead of actually diplomacy. And, like, in the case of Ukraine, you know, sending hundreds of millions of dollars for more, equipment to pierce, you know, tanks instead of sending, you know, diplomats to go and resolve the issue with Russia. You know, if we spent a fraction of the amount of money on diplomacy over weapons, and would these conflicts actually be resolved? Israel and Palestine. I mean, these things keep going on. It almost seems like we're enabling them by continuing to support them with, you know, defense spending.
Right. It's such a great question. And I noticed on social media that after the Democratic debate this week that was moderated by CNN, they spent so much time asking, you know, other than an attack on U.S. soil, what would be another justification for attacking another country? I mean, there were so many questions about why you would attack another country. And actually, CNN, kind of ironic, they just reported that the federal budget deficit, the defense budget, I have to look up this number because it just keeps growing. They never asked about costs, weapons costs, waste, where this money's going. And then when you bring up Medicare for All, that's when the questions about how are you going to pay for it come in. I mean, this is not new, Lee. I mean, we've seen this year after year from many in the media. But, you know, how do you tackle Greg's concern and question?
Well, I think this reflects the power imbalance in Washington, D.C. If you're an interest group, no matter what issue you're working on, you need an infrastructure. You know, you need experts, you need think tanks, you need people who are pitching the media every day, who are lobbying legislators. And the arms industry, the lobby groups that agitate for military escalation and war, they have hundreds of millions of dollars at their disposal. I can rattle off the names of 24 think tanks that push for more military escalation, whether that's AEI or FDD, the two groups I just mentioned, or the Heritage Institute or Heritage Foundation, the Lexington Institute, I mean, the CSIS, the Atlantic Council. There are so many groups that are calling for more defense spending, more military escalation, whether that's in Ukraine, Syria, Iran, in North Africa. But where's the peace lobby? Where are the groups that are calling for more diplomacy? There are one or two foundations that I can think of that advocate for these policy solutions, but they're not very well funded. They're not very powerful. They don't have a super PAC. They don't have a team of lobbyists that are knocking on the doors of legislators on a daily basis. So this imbalance in policy, this imbalance in media narrative, I think reflects the imbalance in political infrastructure. And I think that's a big question that we need to answer in terms of, is there a small donor effort that can fund an alternative in D.C.? Is there a foundation-backed alternative? I don't know. But I think it really speaks to, if you walk through Washington, D.C., and you just kind of take a day and say, I'm going to attend every foreign policy seminar that's hosted on any given week in Washington, D.C., 9 times out of 10, they will be from more hawkish think tanks that are lobbying legislators every day. And I think that's why you see this narrative in D.C. or in the media, that reflects their agenda.
Well, thank you for that phone call. And I did find the numbers. Last month, Trump signed a massive military spending bill authorizing a top line of $738 billion for the next fiscal year. This does not include health care for veterans. I think it's always important to point that out. That same month, the stocks of military weapons companies soared after a defense spending jump, or I should say military weapons spending jump. And Lee, this is completely related to the recent piece you wrote for The Intercept about these TV pundits praising Soleimani's assassination, neglecting to disclose their ties to the arms industry. I mean, as you know, this also applies to these think tanks. You'll hear, you know, John Smith is with the We Love Freedom group, but you never hear, well, who are these people? Where does their money come from? So in this piece you report, Jack Keane, a retired Army general, appeared on Fox and NPR to praise Trump for the strike of Soleimani. He said, quote, it should have happened a long time ago. Now, Keane has worked for military companies, including General Dynamics and Blackwater, and currently serves as a partner for SCP Partners. This is a venture capital firm that invests in defense contractors. So this guy, he was on Fox and NPR and no mention of his ties.
He's been on Fox News, pardon me, on almost a nightly basis, praising Trump's actions, calling for more defense spending. And by the way, over the last 3 years, Trump has won over $130 billion in increases to the Pentagon budget. Wow. And, you know, he's just one of many figures who have appeared on all the major networks calling for military escalation with Iran or praising Trump's actions with the assassination of Soleimani without any skepticism. And, you know, it's not just Fox, you know, on other major networks, on Meet the Press, Jay Johnson, the former Obama administration official, pushed back against Bernie Sanders and others who have said that, you know, these actions lacked congressional authorization, lacked legal authority. He said that Trump was acting within his rights. No mention that Johnson was appointed to the board of Lockheed Martin, paid about $300,000 a year in cash and stock for a very part-time role. We see similar pundits appearing on CBS, NBC, NPR, you know, really across the media. After we published the story, on the Monday, just a few days after the assassination happened. In the last 2 weeks since this news, we've seen so many more examples. You know, James Stavridis, pundit for MSNBC. He works at the McLarty Group. That's a consulting and lobbying firm that advises the defense contracting industry. CBS News's in-house military expert, Admiral James Winfield. He's also a board member of Raytheon. His colleague at Raytheon, Stephen Hadley, who's also on the same board, has appeared on NPR and had a column for The Washington Post. Again, praising Trump's actions with Soleimani. These individuals are paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year by the defense contractors who have a financial stake in the outcome of these policies. And, you know, we did a story last year just looking at the investor reports because, you know, many of the major defense contractors are publicly traded companies. They have a fairly rigorous threshold for public transparency in terms of their business outlook. And they're telling their investment bankers, their investor analysts, what they see as the future for their business prospects. And they were very clear in the last year. They said, we're looking at military tension with Iran as a way to build our business. We see the threat of Iran as a way that we can go to the U.S. government as well as governments in the Persian Gulf, you know. Many American arms contractors sell a lot of weapons to the UAE, to Qatar, to Saudi Arabia. We see rising escalation with Iran as great for our business. So it's very clear that these companies have a stake in the outcome of increased escalation with Iran.
Lee, is there a place people can go to find out when these contracts are given out? I was just reading at military.com last month. a Wisconsin-based company was awarded an $803 million contract for thousands more high-performance vehicles troops will use in combat. This is Oshkosh Defense, and there's going to be like 2,700 joint light tactical vehicles. This contract was issued by the Army. I mean, where can people go to just try to follow the money to find out who's getting all of this money?
Well, Defense One, it's a trade publication, does a pretty good job in covering these contracts. But, you know, in general, this is an area of the government that now crowds out all other spending. The majority of our discretionary spending in the federal budget now goes to the military. This is a big part of our economy, but it really just doesn't receive that much mainstream media coverage. You know, occasionally when there's a scandal, we'll hear about it. But it is difficult to find. And the other kind of aspect of this, you know, I've done a little bit of defense contracting reporting in terms of the big tech companies now bidding for defense contracts. It's very hard to find because in many cases, the true beneficiaries of these contractors are obscured by, you know, what I would describe as front groups. You know, that they're contracting bid vehicles in Northern Virginia that will win the prime contract and then provide the subcontractors, the folks who are actually doing the work. And it's not clear from the government website who are the beneficial winners of these contracts. So it is difficult for the public to find.
In your piece, you also write about David Petraeus, the retired general who once commanded U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. He has appeared on Public Radio International. He declared that, quote, this particular episode has been fairly impressively handled. He praised the Trump administration for moving to shore up our defenses and our offensive capabilities. As you report, he was also on CBS's Face the Nation. Petraeus now works for Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts and Company. This is an investment firm with holdings in several major weapons contractors that's reportedly moving to, quote, build up its defense portfolio at a time when military budgets are skyrocketing. So you're talking about, like you said, former Homeland Security Secretary under Obama, Jay Johnson, who's now on the board of Lockheed. These are Republicans and Democrats who leave government to go get, you know, high paying jobs with weapons companies or venture capital firms that invest in them.
Yeah, this is, you know, the media has done, I think, a very good job in the recent past in scrutinizing President Trump's revolving door appointees at the EPA and the Interior, saying, hey, look, there's a big scandal that Trump is appointing, former oil company lobbyists, former coal company lobbyists, you know, folks who worked in extractive industries to run our environmental policies. That's actually been very well covered. And you know, the media has done a good job of that. But for whatever reason, we don't see the media applying the same level of scrutiny to the military, where we see the same type of scandal happening in administration after administration with high-level national security, State Department, and Pentagon officials leaving the government, going to take these arms contractor jobs, and then coming back and rewarding their buddies with their former colleagues with major contracts, or leaving the government and then defending the arms contracting industry or promoting their policies. It's really a bipartisan scandal. I wish that in one of these Democratic debates for the presidential primary, that this issue would be raised, because it's a big question. Will the next Democratic president, if they win the White House this year, will they continue this trend of hiring a lot of these defense contractors and placing them into their government? It's a bipartisan issue that really isn't scrutinized.
Lee, have you reached out to any of the media outlets like NPR, Face the Nation, Meet the Press, to ask them why they don't reveal the connections their guests have to the weapons industries?
Absolutely. I've reached out to every single media outlet that we mentioned in our piece, and we didn't hear back from a single one of them. And this is, a repeat issue. And 4 years ago, I reported a kind of similar story about many of the pundits reporting on the 2016 Democratic primary on cable news without reporting that they were being paid by one of the candidates, in many cases, Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton was their campaigns and super PACs were paying the actual pundits who were going on air and being portrayed as independent political analysts and then boosting their candidates on TV. And in that case, none of the networks responded to me. But we saw in the week after we reported that story that the network started doing a better job of disclosing who the pundits were working for. In this case, so far we haven't seen the networks changing their behavior.
And we should also say that Boeing is a major sponsor of Meet the Press with Chuck Todd, you know, one of the top three political shows on Sundays. So maybe a good thing to do, I think it was, I forgot our listener's name, I'm looking back. Let's see, one of our listeners called and said, you know, what can we do? Maybe this would be a good thing, is write to various media organizations and say, if you're going to have these guys on, you need to be transparent about their connections to these weapons companies.
I agree.
Well, Lee, as always, thank you so much for your great reporting. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Thank you. Lee Fong is an investigative reporter with The Intercept. He does an incredible job of following the money and uncovering this kind of information. And you can find his piece, TV Pundits Praising Soleimani Assassination, Neglect to Disclose Ties to the Arms Industry. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and Jonathan Linden, our studio engineer. Our intern, Damian Miners, our studio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.